Good to see you here in person for a change. Go ahead and be seated. All right, the next place, matter we have on calendar is docket number 79140, Housley versus State. Council, are you ready to proceed? Yes, we appreciate the masks, but as you're up here on the podium, please feel free to take those off. Would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, yes.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Brian Housley. The first issue that I address in the brief is insufficiency of the evidence. And unless the court has any questions about that issue, I'd like to talk about issues 2 and 3, which both involve a fair cross-section violation. No question. Issue 2 addresses the third step in a fair cross-section violation and discusses what is needed in order to obtain an evidentiary hearing with the jury commissioner. Now, this case went to trial twice. In both instances, there were zero prospective jurors who were Hispanic, and there were too few African Americans. Brian raised a challenge to the veneer in both instances. He presented two main arguments. His first argument was the jury commissioner was not using all four sources for the jury master list as required by NRS 6.045. His second objection was the jury commission was not allowing jurors to have the option of selecting Hispanic as race or ethnicity. Now, the court denied this challenge. The court relied on a transcript and a case based on an outdated jury selection process. The court concluded, without any evidence, that the jury commissioner was using all four sources. So, should Brian have been given an evidentiary hearing? And the answer with the jury commissioner, and the answer is yes. The reason for that is Valentine tells us that if a defendant asserts a reason for the lack of minorities in his veneer that would amount to systematic exclusion, then he's entitled to a hearing. So he's only required to assert facts that, if true, would show systematic exclusion. Well, he did that. Not using all four sources as required is a violation of the Essential Provisions Clause of NRS 6.045. Now, the legislator added two additional sources in July of 2017, and those additional sources were records from Dieter and also the voter registration. Brian's case went to trial in 2019. We don't know if the jury commissioner was complying at this time. Now, it's important that these other two sources be included, because at the time that the legislature was considering these sources, several attorneys testified and told the legislature we're having a problem with not having an adequate fair cross-representation of the jurors in our jury pools. So that was the reason that the legislature added the two sources. Now, as far as the essential provision of NRS 6.045, I cited several cases from other states that recognize that when the jury commissioner is now following the rules that are in place to go ahead and establish a fair cross-section for the veneer, then she's violated that essential provision and she systematically has excluded people from the jury's master list. Now, it's important to note that just today, Justice Hardesty issued an order ordering Dieter to go ahead and give records. And because he issued that order, we know that this provision is extremely important to be in the jury master list. Another problem with the jury master list at this time was the jury commissioner excluded Hispanics as an option for race or ethnicity. Now, I know the trial judge said, well, it's not race. But the Second Circuit, in looking at this issue as to whether Hispanic is race or ethnicity or whether it should be included, it said, well, yes, you know, for purposes of Section 1981, it is race and it is an option that people should be allowed.
Ms. Dickinson?
Yes.
In 2017, were counties required to ascertain the race of jurors on their forms? Is there a requirement somewhere that says you have to get a statistical analysis?
Well, in 2017, when they passed this, it said that the jury commissioner is supposed to take track of the race of prospective jurors to make sure that it conforms with the fair cross-section. And I know even before that, when I was doing trials, the jury commissioner in Clark County always did that. So I would say, yes, they need to keep track of that. With regard to issue two, the fair cross-section violation is because Ryan was convicted by an all-white jury because the state removed the only two African-American jurors on the panel. Now, Ryan did not object to the removal of one of them, but he did object to the removal of juror number four. And when he made the objection, the prosecutor said, well, she expressed the belief that she has an extreme bias towards the state, that the justice system is biased against African-Americans. She would hold us to a higher standard. She has a bias that would cause her to hesitate with beyond a reasonable doubt. Defense disagreed and said, although she said she may need more than one piece of evidence, she didn't say she wouldn't convict. She just needed to look at the evidence. Well, the court made two rulings. One, the court sua sponte decided, well, I should have removed her for hardship. And as I argue in the brief, there was no hardship. Originally, the court said no, but then faced with this for-cause challenge and a jury with no African-Americans and an African-American defendant, he decided to make a different ruling on the for-cause, for the hardship. And then as far as the for-cause, his ruling was that she hesitated. So is a hesitation in response to a question enough to remove a juror for cause? No.
But Ms. Dickinson, I mean, there's case law, and I know we just had one recently, somebody was sleeping, and the district court judge said, well, I noticed her sleeping, or her eyes shut during this time. Isn't the district court in the best position to know and to see and observe a juror in order to make that call for cause challenge, their demeanor?
When you're talking about demeanor, and he said that she hesitated, you have to look at the total record. Because this wasn't, he didn't say specifically what question it was she hesitated at one time. But if you look at the record as a whole, and then you have to decide if the juror's opinion would prevent or substantially impair their ability to abide by the oath and by the rules of the court, determine the facts, adjudicate the facts fairly. And the test is, it has to be unmistakably clear that this juror had this bias that would interfere.
Ms. Dickinson, what about the question, though, that the defendant asked, do you think you'd be able to give the state a fair shake in listening to the evidence presented? And the juror responded, I have to see, I cannot, yay or definitely yay, definitely nay. It depends on, for me, what is presented. I can't definitively say. And I can't definitively say is, are you going to give the state a fair shake? Why isn't that question sufficient? Now, she did say, I'll listen to everything. But is that sufficient, such that we'd say that her being taken off the jury is error?
Well, I interpret when she's saying she needed to look at all the evidence is that she wanted to be thorough. She was cautious about what she wanted to say. I know there were a lot of questions that were asked her about how she would vote, and she always did seem to say, well, I need to see the evidence, or if there's only one witness, how do I judge credibility? But, of course, there was more than one witness here. There were several witnesses, and then there was the video. So I don't think that one question, that one answer, would remove her. And I was very troubled by some of the questions during voir dire by the prosecutor when he compared the trial to a race. And he asked her if the defendant, who was African-American, he didn't say African-American, but he said, would the defendant be ahead in the race? These types of questions, the way I interpret it, are rather race-baiting because you don't decide you don't make the decision after all the evidence is in. And he suggested to her you could be swayed along the way, and that's improper. Did the court have any other questions about this issue?
Just about your argument regarding this state not, and I'll ask the state the same thing, so be prepared. What relieves the state its duty under the statute of endorsing or noticing witnesses just based on a mere filing of an alibi witness? Oh. I mean, you prepare, what was the argument? And I mean, I looked at the transcript, but what is your argument to us that that was prejudicial under these circumstances?
Well, in this case, it was prejudicial because in the opening statement, we were not able to counter what Helen was going to testify to because we didn't know that she was going to testify. And the reason the state brought her in is because they were suggesting that she had seen Brian with $27 or $47 at some other time, and they wanted to suggest, well, maybe this was the money from the alleged robbery. We had listed her as an alibi witness, told we had to remove her, which we did, and then the court said you can't remove her. I think that there's a problem here because when you're doing an alibi witness, you're giving up your defense. And so now the state did not go ahead and notice her as any kind of witness, rebuttal, alibi, or regular, and just marched her on in. So the prejudice is that we had no idea that this evidence was going to come in, couldn't prepare for it, and obviously weren't prepared with Helen's testimony. Any other questions? Or no?
No.
Okay. I think I've used my time, have I?
Well, just no, you've still got 4 minutes left.
Okay, I'll save that for rebuttal.
Yes.
Please, the court, John Nyman on behalf of respondent, State of Nevada. I'd like to start this argument actually where the state ended it in closing arguments and trial, and that's a reminder that from a 1,000-foot view, this is a very simple case. Right? The defendant paid for sex with two prostitutes. About 2 weeks later, met up with those same two women, lured one into an alley under the guise of another sexual encounter, took her $47, robbed her of it, ran away when a bystander came down, was seen on a bus about half a mile down the road.
Let me stop you. If it's that simple, why did you put in the alibi witness for the defense? If it's that simple, you guys tried it the first time and it hung. If it's that simple, why not just try it again with the simple facts of what you're stating? Why muddy this and not follow the statute, which expressly says you have to notice witnesses in your case in chief if you're going to use them? How does filing alibi get you out of that as the state?
So Justice Silver, in the second trial, we included the witness Helen Christensen because she had some probative information, namely that she saw.
So why didn't you notice her? You clearly subpoenaed her. You clearly had an investigator talk to her. And I saw Ms. Clower said, oh, I didn't know what she was going to say, but you were looking for her. And they were looking to subpoena her. Why wouldn't you, you know, all of these witness lists have 30, 40, 50 witnesses and you use five, if it's that simple. Why wouldn't you let the defense know that you're going to use a witness that says that they saw this defendant with $47 or $27, which is exactly what was taken?
So certainly for a general witness, the only thing that you have to notice is that that person is a witness. I direct the court, I can, let me get the numbers here. So for each of the notices of witnesses, this goes all the way back even to the first trial. State's notices of witnesses are at 1AA 226 to 28, 2AA 436 to 39, 3AA 454 to 56.
I know you notice witnesses all the way along.
Correct.
Like any other case.
And so as part of that notice of witnesses, we notice the witnesses that we're going to call, and then we also notice witnesses, quote, any other witness for which a separate notice of witnesses or expert witness has been filed. We incorporate all witnesses that are going to be called by reference that way. It's the same reason why the defense is able to call a state witness. If the state notices a witness, decides not to call them, but the defense thinks that they have some valuable information, the defense can call that witness and question them. Because the purpose of a notice of witness is to allow the other party to investigate that witness, to talk with them, and to determine what they're going to say. And in fact,
but procedurally, the statute says, list your witnesses in your case in chief. The defense, this witness was never listed in a case in chief. Why would they think until opening statement that you're going to have the girlfriend who's going to talk about the recovery of the money? How would the defense ever know that? And I read the transcript. Ms. Clowersa, she analyzed this close to what we learned about a jail call in the middle of trial in Judge Herndon's court. It's not the same thing. They obviously knew about this witness prior to opening. Why wouldn't they make some motion, even them, to the court prior to opening statement to endorse the witness prior to calling in the case in chief, which is mandated by statute? It doesn't say except for if it's alibi witness, you don't have to endorse the witness.
Correct, Justice Silver. And I don't think that the argument is that we felt that we didn't have to notice the witness. I think that we did notice the witness by referencing any other notice of witness that had been filed.
Well, then anybody can be called.
Anybody that has been noticed on a witness of notice. I'm not suggesting that some random person could just be called if they don't show up anywhere.
That's not what was argued to the district court either, by the way.
What was argued to the district court is notice is notice. And that's what the district court also found. They had noticed this, the defense had noticed this witness, had talked to the witness. At 7 Appellant's Appendix 1587, the defense admitted, yes, we've talked to this witness. We know what this witness is going
That's
to
say. That's not what that said. I read the transcript just during lunch, and it said, I forgot even what she was. The defense counsel represented, I don't even remember what she told us, because we never expected to see her at trial. And they said they're prejudiced. They had no idea what she was going to say on the stand. They would have gotten their investigator to go take a statement from her.
My understanding is if the court looks at 7 AA 1587, you will see that the defense said that we had talked to the witness and we knew what she was going to say. That's the record that I have, and that's my understanding of what that is going to say. Are there any other questions on that topic?
No, on that topic.
Did you have different questions?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
This is so good. How do you meaningfully distinguish Valentine from the lack of an evidentiary hearing here on the cross section?
So I view what happened in the cross section of the second trial very differently than I heard it on argument before. And so my understanding is that if the court looks, and this is at 6 Appellant's Appendix 1265 to 66, when the defense is making their objection at trial, the defense states that they, quote, cannot tell, end quote, if there's a fair cross section of the community because they, quote, could guess that some people are Latino, end quote, but they didn't know. And also as part of that, they had said that they thought that African Americans were underrepresented. But essentially what the defense objected to at trial was that they looked at the veneer that was in front of them and they couldn't tell whether a particular group was underrepresented or not. And so the district court said, look, one, you're not precluded from asking if you'd like to know what these potential jurors identify as. Second of all, the court, this is at 6 AA 1400 to 01, relied on Williams v. State, which held that even if there's variations in a particular veneer, that's not sufficient to demonstrate systemic exclusion as an overall juror selection process. Mm-hmm. And I'm to some degree troubled because much of the statistical argument, much of the argument about the statute and what the jury commissioner was supposed to rely on did not appear to be relied on below. And so my understanding is that Judge Villani was basically ruling on an objection that said, we don't know how many people are on here, and so we think that they're systemically excluded, and on that basis denied the challenge.
Did they raise then the issue of not drawing from the Dieter and the other lists?
Yeah, I think that they had mentioned that perhaps they weren't drawing from that list, but drawing from that list would only matter if they could somehow show that that actually caused systemic exclusion. And they didn't even, as far as I could see, argue that. They just weren't sure if the jury commissioner was following the procedures that they thought that they should at that time.
Do you think an evidentiary hearing with the jury commissioner would help answer that question, or do you think there's a totally independent analysis? Because we get these veneer challenges, And it's always, everybody wants to talk to the jury commissioner. Is there some other piece, though, that independently could be pursued to find out, even if we get Dieter, is that going to solve that problem? Is that the what's going to make this a fair cross-section, or at least a statistically fair cross-section?
Sure. And this is going outside the record. This is just my personal opinion. But the way that I see it is that, yes, probably some kind of evidentiary hearing at some point. The jury commissioner is going to have to explain, as she has before, sure. But under these circumstances, how it is that the entire veneer is selected. Because clearly under Williams, if you just look at who shows up in a particular courtroom, you don't know what the composition is two doors down, two floors down, or who showed up that day, that month, etc. And so really the only person who's going to be able to explain it is probably the jury commissioner. There might be some other people that I'm not aware of off the top of my head. But you're not, I think, going to get that evidentiary hearing by looking at who's in front of you. I think that that's a hearing that should happen, quite frankly, outside of the middle of a trial somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's always a live issue because some number of people of some amount of races are going to be called in every single trial. And so having that information, I would hope, would, one, quash any concerns, or two, if there is some kind of exclusion, would alert that and be able to take corrective measures in front of it. I think that that's probably the best idea overall.
You think in the middle of trial?
No, Justice Silver. I'm sorry. I was saying outside of the middle of trial.
Didn't I get reversed on that in Buchanan? Okay. Wait a second. I'm sorry. I thought you said outside of trial.
Outside of the trial, yes, but not in the middle of. were there any other questions in particular?
I have a question as to, can you explain to me, I actually have two questions. One question would be, how is the defense being disingenuous on cross-examination of the state's witness, the probation officer? In order to get into veterans court, you have to be a veteran.
Sure.
So he clearly was a veteran, right, to get into veterans court. How is that being so disingenuous that it allows the state to then come in and bring in a prior bad act without permission from the court?
So I don't think it was necessarily disingenuous. I think that looking at what happened at the first trial and what happened at the second trial kind of explains it. So in the first trial, we were going to call this witness. Basically, what we needed was the defendant's address and phone number. They didn't want to stipulate to that. That's fine. But his PNP officer knew who it was. Right. Obviously, we can't tell the jury, hey, he's being supervised. That's why they know the address and phone number. And so there was a discussion about how to reference it. And eventually, they just settled on veterans meetings. State's kind of uncomfortable with it because veteran is kind of good character evidence, and now we're introducing good character of the defendant to prevent the jury from hearing bad character of the defendant. But we went with it for the purposes of the first trial. First trial went through, and sure enough, in closing, the defense references the fact that the defendant's a veteran, brings this character evidence in.
So we met him in veterans treatment, which is true.
Correct.
He was a veteran, which is true.
That's correct. But they wouldn't have had any other way to get that information in. It wasn't relevant to anything, and the defendant never testified.
Well, how he knows him and can describe his body and demeanor is certainly relevant. And how he knows him without bringing in another bad act. There's like 50 ways to do it, maybe 100.
Absolutely.
But then why bring in a bad act without asking permission from the court?
So in the first trial, because this veterans meeting was how it was decided to be played out, that made sense on cross-examination. The second trial, we didn't want to get anywhere near trying to bring in good character evidence. We were going to make it much more neutral. You're an employee of the state of Nevada. You know this information. That's it. We didn't reference veteran. We didn't reference veterans meeting. Nothing. And so on cross-examination, the defense says, well, you know him from veterans meetings, right? They bring in this good character evidence, not to rebut anything that happened on direct, but presumably because they want to use it in closing.
Why aren't they allowed to do that? Because that's true. It wasn't false. It's true.
It's true, but it's not relevant. The only reason to ask that question is to bring in character evidence. And having brought in character evidence, we are allowed to correct the record and just say, you mean veterans treatment court. And at that point, the defense objected. They went up to the sidebar. They asked for a mistrial. The judge said, well, you know, he understands because he had the first trial as well. Same judge presided over both. Said, look, not going to declare a mistrial. It was one passing comment. State, don't go into it anymore, and we didn't. Defense, don't bring it up in closing, and they didn't. And the judge offered an admonishment, which the defense rejected. And so that all having been done, everybody just moved on.
And can you help me understand the relevance? You know, I read both transcripts of the jail calls. Besides him being in jail and claiming somebody, a third person, what is the relevance versus the prejudicial effect of the jail calls? I mean, generally when we see jail calls, they're I did it, or, you know, they're making up stuff. And here, it's almost exculpatory, it appears, at least by reading a cold record.
Sure, and I think the state had a different view of it, because there was two things that were important in the jail call. It's Exhibit 25 now that ended up getting admitted. The first was that he was looking at this video from the bus and saying, man, there's really somebody that looks like me on the bus. I think he's talking to his girlfriend at the time. And the second is, at least from the state's perspective, he's trying to encourage his girlfriend to testify to an alibi defense, right? To put him somewhere that's not where the crime occurred. And that's some evidence that, one, he recognizes how bad the situation is, and two, that he's trying to set up this defense. Now, in the second trial, we did not and were not allowed to mention that he had filed a notice of alibi or that he was intending on presenting an alibi defense in the first case, but it was fair game, as Judge Volani ruled, to say that he was trying to set up an alibi. Not that he was presenting that defense, but that he was trying to make that maneuver. I have about 30 seconds left, which I don't think is quite enough. If there's any other questions?
No, thank you.
No?
Thank you.
Oh, thank
I
you.
Keep my 30 seconds.
Starting with the alibi notice, my understanding was defense counsel said she did not know what Helen was going to testify to, had not talked to her for a long time. So she was surprised that Helen was there. With regard to the probation officer, that issue, it had been resolved in the first trial, you know, that they could say veterans meetings, and the court prohibited them from bringing in that he was a probation officer. If you look at the transcript, it's very clear he's a probation officer because he testified, I know his address, I know where he is, I know him from veterans court. So that certainly was prejudicial. With regard to the jail calls, they edited a 16-minute jail call to 4.5 minutes, and more than 2 minutes of that was just talking about him being in jail, where they have that little talk about, this is a call from Clark County, you know you're being recorded. Then they use that to argue in closing he was trying to set up some kind of an alibi or something. I don't remember them using the words alibi, but they said he knew he was being recorded. So that was very prejudicial.
Now, based on what you're saying, looking at the Valentine issue, that's just a remand for an evidentiary hearing. You're talking error after error. Is this cumulative in this case?
Yes. Yes, it is. Because you have the probation officer, you have the alibi with Helen, you have also the problem with the jury and the jury notes that we discussed in there. I think it was one issue where we argued the jury was coerced. We had the foreperson who gave us a declaration after the trial that talked about what occurred. So yes, there are a lot of errors here. And there's the court's improper comment on the Fifth Amendment, which was fleeting, but it's in there. And then we had a problem with the motion to reconstruct because we could not give you the full tape. The court wouldn't allow us to give you that.
Ms. Jameson, I've never seen, well, maybe it's just me, I haven't seen the issue that you're claiming as far as the district court judge asking a defense, are you going to present a defense, or, you know, how would you suggest a district court ask if they're going to begin their case in chief? Is that what you're saying? They have to say case in chief versus?
Well, I would suggest that the court just say defense, you know, what's your position or something. I've not seen a lot of judges use those exact words, you know, are you going to present any witnesses? I have to go back to see what they say, but I was kind of surprised when I saw this, because the state had rested, and then he asked, do you want to present witnesses? So that's a problem. He could just say defense, and they say, I rest. I'm not sure what the other judges say. I don't know if you have any other questions about any of these or about Valentine, or I do know that they did talk about the four sources, but they didn't specifically say Dieter. In issue one, they did talk about the four sources, but nobody specifically said Dieter. However, we have in other cases found out that the Dieter records have not been included. So.
Would it be your position that absent the, if it's confirmed that the Dieter records are not part of the jury veneer, that by definition is not a fair cross-section?
Go ahead and answer, yes.
Yeah, it's a violation of a substantial provision of NRS 6.045, which is in place to make sure there is a fair cross-section.
Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay, anything else? All right, counsel, thank you, for your arguments today and the briefing in this matter. And we will take this matter as submitted, and the court will stand at ease until we reconstitute for the next.